I'm delighted to welcome to the program Bill Robichaud. He's a wildlife biologist. He's the coordinator of the Sao La Working Group, and Bill Dubuis, who's a writer and conservationist. They were both with us a little under a year ago talking about this critically endangered mammal called the Sao La. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here, Mary
Charlotte. Great to be here with you.
So let's start by reminding people or telling people who never heard the show in the first place what this beautiful, strange mammal is, the Sao La.
Well, it's probably the most remarkable animal a lot of people have never heard of. It looks like an antelope or an Arabian oryx, if people know what that looks like, but it's actually not. It's kind of its own thing. It's very distinctive, and it lives only in forests of Laos and Vietnam. And the interesting thing, it was completely unknown to the outside world, to nobody but villagers until 1992. And it was probably the most spectacular zoological discovery of the 20th century.
And these are bovine mammals. They're in the cow family.
Right.
But they're small and very unusual looking.
Yeah, they're about the size of a white-tailed deer. Their closest genetic relatives are wild cattle and wild buffalo, but they look nothing like that. They have very long, straight horns, about 2 feet long, and beautiful white spots on the faces, on their sides of their faces, sort of like some of the African antelope. But again, it's not an antelope. The best way I can say it is there's one species of Sao La in the world, and it's the Sao La.
When I looked at them, I thought that they were unicorns, except that they had two horns. They have that sort of strange, straight-horned, magical thing about them. Now, this is one of the most remarkable conservation stories of the 20th century.
Right. Now, I'll also add, they're a bit like unicorns in another way. No biologist has ever seen this animal in the wild. They've only been seen in the wild by local people. I've seen one in captivity. We have some automatic camera trap photographs of them taken in the forest. We get very detailed information from local people about seeing them. But no, this is probably by far the largest animal in the world nobody from the scientific community has ever seen in the wild. So it's an incredible story.
Why are they so hard to see? They're afraid of predators?
No, I don't think it's that. One thing is they're very rare. They're at low density. They live in very dense forests, which is hard to see things in. They're solitary, so they're not in big, easily seen herds. And the local people I've talked to in Laos, where I've spent most of my time the last 15 years, say that they have a nickname for this animal. They call it the polite animal, Satsupap in Lao. Because they say the Sao La always walks very slowly and quietly through the forest and never really gets upset at anything, but is also very wary.
Now, what do they eat?
They're a browser, so they eat... We actually don't know much about Sao La, but we're quite sure it's a browser, that it feeds on leaves.
How was it discovered?
A team of scientists from the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, and the government of Vietnam decided to do a general biodiversity and wildlife survey of a nature reserve in Vietnam near the border with Laos in 1992. This was a Vu Quang Nature Reserve. They went down there, and in the course of their work, they started seeing these spectacular horns nailed to the walls of the houses of local hunters, horns unlike anything else known in Southeast Asia. And they asked the hunters, what the heck are these things? And the hunters said, that's the Sao La. And they said, what's a Sao La? And they said, that's this animal running around the forest with the wild pigs and the deer. To them, it was just, another part of their environment. It was an animal completely bizarre, completely unknown. It blew the minds of the zoological community around the world. It was the most spectacular, unusual find since this sort of forest giraffe, the okapi, in Africa. But that was found in 1900. This was found, almost 100 years later.
Now, this is an area of the world that was really badly bombed during the Vietnam War.
Right. Laos is about the size of Oregon, half the size of California, roughly. At the time of the Vietnam War, it had 3 million people. The Ho Chi Minh Trail ran mostly through Laos during the Vietnam War, and that attracted the attention of the U.S. Air Force. And more bombs were dropped on Laos, then were dropped on all countries of Europe during World War II. It has the unfortunate distinction of being the most bombed country per capita in the history of warfare. And where the Sawlah lives, it only lives in this spectacular ecosystem, the Annamite Mountains along the Lao-Vietnam border. And the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran through the southern end of this. So I'm sure the B-52s killed a lot of Sawlah during the war, and Agent Orange had an effect and so forth.
The Annamite Mountains, this is an area that I hadn't really been aware of. What is this area like?
It is the great, or one of the great untold conservation stories in the world. Once the Sawlah was discovered there in 1992, biologists there started sort of keeping their eyes open in that area, and four other new species of larger mammals. I mean, we're not talking about mice and bats, but larger things were discovered in the Annamites. Two new species of deer, a species of wild pig that had been thought extinct for possibly 100 years, a new species of rabbit, an entirely new taxonomic family of mammal that was thought to be a new family. It actually turned out to be a mammalian family that was last seen in the fossil record 5 million years ago.
Oh my goodness. And they can figure out that it's the same thing.
Yeah, they know it's the same family. This thing has been thought gone from the earth for 5 million years. It's been living out in the Annamite Mountains. Last year, colleagues of mine described a new bald songbird, this bizarre bald songbird from the same area. I mean, there have been half a dozen species of birds found in the area. An anthropologist.
And this is after all these bombings.
Yeah,
I mean, imagine
right.
what it was like before. Well, it's hard to
yeah.
say how much actually goes extinct in a situation
right.
like that.
Yeah. And an anthropologist friend of mine in 1996 went into a large protected area I work in Laos, Nakhai Nam Thun. And in the course of a couple of weeks, he discovered four new ethnic groups and four new languages of people who had very recently been hunter-gatherers in the forest that were completely unknown to the world. And he called this area, he said, this is an area of global linguistic megadiversity.
Oh,
so what's fascinating about the Annamites, I mean, five new species of larger mammals since the late 1990s, that's by far the highest rate of significant species discovery in any place in the world since Europeans probably went to Africa. And you have married with that the largest block of forests left in Laos or Vietnam, and this incredible cultural diversity of people who are, many of them are as integrated with the forest as is Sawlah. It's one of the most fascinating places on the planet.
So when people talk about indigenous cultures being really close to nature and living off of the land, these people are a real example of that.
They're doing it. I mean, some of my guides, they were born in the forest. They wore bark clothing. They had nothing made out of metal, but one machete they shared amongst 12 families. And they did almost no agriculture, very little agriculture. They're basically hunter-gatherers. And living in the same area as the Sawlah. And the reason these discoveries came so late was partly the Vietnam War. I mean, there weren't a lot of biologists going and anthropologists going into the highlands of Laos and Vietnam during this terrible period of the Vietnam War. And after the war, the Vietnam instituted a communist government in Laos at the same time at about 1975. And of course, they had a period of sort of retrenchment and withdrawal from the world and just recovery. You know, and they weren't so enthusiastic about having foreign powers come in anymore. They'd been a French colony for 100 years, and then sort of under the domination of American war for a period after that, they'd kind of had enough. And they sort of, you know, they didn't quite close the countries down, but almost just for this period of recovery. So there were no biological surveys going, you know, during this period either.
And so here you are, conservation biologist, who's focusing on this mammal, the Sawlah, but cognizant that that exists within this area of cultural, linguistic, and biological diversity
right.
that is under all kinds of threats.
Right, yeah. Sawlah is only the most spectacular species that's been discovered. I mean, there are several more and a lot more things going on there.
I'm going to put a link on the website for people who are listening on santafe.radiocafe.org so people can actually see a photograph of this animal.
Okay, great. Yeah. It's one of the most beautiful animals I've ever seen. And I had experience with this captive in 1996. A general in Central Laos who had his own little very small private zoo, he learned about this new rare animal that had been discovered in the area where he lived. And so he put out a reward to villagers in the area that he would pay them if anybody could capture a sawlaw for a zoo. And they succeeded, and they sent this sawlaw down to his little zoo. And just by stroke of luck, I learned about it within 24 hours and was down at the zoo where she had just arrived 2 days before. So she'd been in captivity about 3 days by that time. It was an adult female, nicknamed her Martha, which is another story. It was the most amazing wild animal I'd ever been around. And the main thing is, as I said, that's where the villagers told me they called it the polite animal. She was completely trusting and tame around people. She'd been in captivity for 3-4 days. She had no fear. She would feed out of your hand. I could go in the cage with her, and you know, I was looking in her ears for ticks and measuring her while she just stood there. And the general had wild deer and other animals that had been in his menagerie for a year or more, and they were still skittish as, you know, as anything else. And it wasn't just like this bizarre behavior from stress of capture, because she was very afraid of dogs, the sawlaw. Any small dog came near the cage, she got a smell of that, and she got very, very stressed out. And the local people who came to look at her, because they were as interested in seeing this animal as I was, they said, yeah, the only thing sawlaw is afraid of is dogs. Unfortunately, she only lived 18 days. She was probably getting insufficient diet, and she died. That was the only adult sawlaw that's ever been seen by basically the outside world. And there are none in any zoos in any... That was the last one that was ever in any kind of a zoo.
Now, very recently, there was a sawlaw captured who also died in captivity. It seems that they are not compatible with human captivity, unlike many zoo animals, which might not like it, but they survive.
Right. There was. We got word. It was big news. About August 22nd, just, you know, less than 2 months ago, villagers in Laos captured an adult male sawlaw. And for reasons that are not yet clear, they brought it back to their village alive. And not only did they did that, they sent word down. They sent a runner or a message down to the district authorities about 2 days' walk away that they had the sawlaw. So in coordination with our sawlaw working group and the Wildlife Conservation Society's program in Laos that had a project in this area, we scrambled a team to go up to the village, just quickly get some basic information from the animal and see that it was released as soon as possible to the forest. Unfortunately, by the time the team got up there, it had already been in captivity for almost a week, and she was so weak she was lying down and died, or he was lying down and died several hours later. But this is the first indisputable confirmed record of the species since a camera trap photograph in 1999. We know it's there, we know it's out there, because we have very specific information from villagers who have seen it. But this was the first photograph of a living sawlaw since 1999.
Now, why did they capture it?
We haven't quite sorted out the story connected with that. My sense is, and I have some information, that it was a misguided intention at conservation. You know, a little bit of a knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And I think they knew that sawlaw was this threatened species. The government was interested. And so they had this idea, okay, we've come across this one caught in a snare, we think it was. We'll bring it back to the village so, you know, the authorities can conserve it and maybe keep it alive in a zoo.
Why are they so threatened right now? In other words, they're running around in this place in the wild. Is there development there, or what's going on?
The main threat is hunting and poaching, illegal hunting, for animals valued in traditional Chinese medicine. You know, unfortunately, as you know, China has a very large population. It started getting very prosperous, and their demand is emptying the forests of Southeast Asia of all types of wildlife used in traditional Chinese medicines.
What are some other examples of that?
Anything you can think of. Turtles, snakes, monkeys, cats, wild cattle, deer, you know, for the antlers. There's a turtle in the Annamite Mountains, a little box turtle. Beautiful little thing just in the forest. And I mean, the average per capita annual income of a rural Lao villager in the forest areas might be, you know, $800 or $1,000. If a villager finds one of these turtles, he can sell it to a wildlife trader for about $8,000 US, because it's believed to cure cancer in China. The funny thing is, the sort of the tragedy, but the great hope for the conservation of this beautiful animal, the sao la, it's one of the only things that has no price on its head because the Chinese never knew it. Doesn't
right.
occur in China.
So it's not a cure for anything.
No, they don't have any. They don't even know it. So there's no demand for it. The horns of a sao la are worth less than the horns of a sambar deer, which is much more common and found all over the world. Sao la is bycatch, but the hunters are going into the forest. They're setting wire snares by the hundreds and the thousands to catch these other things. And of course, snares are blind, and you know, sao la walks into it, and they catch the sao la.
Now, do their bodies get recovered? I mean, do you see these sao las that are ever caught in traps?
No, these are fairly remote areas, and you know, quite. I mean, I've been on. We were on a patrol in this area in the Kainamtun last year. I was on the ranger patrol with the protected area staff, and in about 8 days, we found 1,200 wire snares in the forest. And one of them had one of these new rare species of deer. Could have been a sao la, but it was this thing called the large antlered muntjac. The carcass was completely rotted, no use to anybody anymore. If they happen to find it when it's fresh, yeah, they'll eat it. But I bet there's a lot of sao la that are just rotting in these snares. You know, they're caught in the snare, probably takes them 3 or 4 days to die, and then they rot and go to waste.
We're talking to wildlife biologist Bill Robichaud about the sao la. Now, what are some of the strategies that you're using to save this animal?
Well, since we talked last, Mary Charlotte, a couple new exciting things have happened. The most urgent priority for sao la, just to keep it from going extinction, is to get the snares and the illegal hunters out of the forest. Now, in Laos and Vietnam, there are a lot of protected areas and nature reserves, including those that have sao la. But they have small budgets. The staff aren't well-trained. They're not well-motivated. Especially in Vietnam, they may have ranger patrol teams. But they don't go out on patrol much. Their salary is very small. It's very difficult work and can be dangerous work. And what to Vietnam's great credit, in the last year, it established 2 new nature reserves to protect sao la. So the World Wildlife Fund program in Vietnam, working with the sao la working group, we came up with sort of this great idea. Let's work with the Vietnamese government to provide them some of the salaries for these new rangers in exchange for being involved in recruiting them, training them, supervising them, and giving them a higher salary and more motivation, and actually giving them a highly trained supervisor to check on their work. And the government of Vietnam has accepted this. And this is going to be a great leap forward for effective protected area management in Vietnam. But patrolling and enforcement are necessary, but they're not sufficient. In the long term, we just have to have people want to have sao la in their forest. They have to have some motivation in their own self-interest to have it there. So we're going to trial in hopefully next year in Laos with support from the Liz Claiborne and Art Ortenberg Foundation in an area of villages in this remote area of Laos where there are sao la. And I've been working with these villagers for more than 10 years. I know the village headmen and that. We have quite good relationships with them. We're going to set up, if the villagers agree to it, we're going to set up a more or less permanent array of digital camera traps in their forests. Maybe 40 camera traps.
Now, explain to us what a camera trap is.
A camera trap is a digital camera, usually digital these days, in a waterproof housing with an infrared sensor. And you just put it on a tree in the forest, like maybe looking at an animal trail with a bungee cord. And anything that's warm and moving sets off the sensor and actually it automatically takes a picture of whatever moved in front of the camera.
So it's like a motion detector, so instead of turning on the light on your porch, it makes your camera take a picture.
Exactly. And the ones with a long battery life, you can leave them in the forest for 2 months and come back and then see what's been photographed over
the
2 months.
That's so cool.
So we're going to, if the villagers agree to it, we're going to put these in their forest and pay them. Every time a sao la is photographed in their forest. You know, maybe $200, maybe $100. Maybe it'll go into a village fund to benefit their school, which, you know, they have a building, they have a teacher. These rural schools in Laos don't have a lot of in the way of books and paper. And what happens then, right now, they for all this snaring and hunting they're doing, you know, they're earning money from the wildlife they catch, and they might actually be getting some meat from the Sawla. This now makes the continued presence of Sawla in their forests an economic asset. And the thing about Sawla, if villagers don't kill it, they're not losing a lot. It's not an important source of food for them. It doesn't eat their crops. Just making a little, you know, sort of tipping point where they can actually make money by having it, then maybe the next time they're out hunting and an animal jumps up and they see it's a Sawla, they won't pull the trigger. Or if they run across a snare that poachers have set in their forest, they'll take the time to pull all the snares up, because now the snares represent a possible economic loss for them if it catches a Sawla. So we're going to try this. And I've done this kind of thing before with villagers elsewhere in Laos, and it worked really well. And what happens in the course of working with the villagers, they become proud of Sawla. Finally, you know, Laos, one of the world's least developed countries and so forth, and these villagers have something no one else in the world has. And they start becoming proud of having this thing.
Bill, once upon a time, didn't villagers ask you how many Sawla are in your country, the United States?
Yeah, when you talk to them, you go and talk to them about Sawla, they say, oh, William. You know, because they know America has a lot of stuff, you know, and America is kind of, you know, everything, or so we think so. There must be a lot of Sawla in America, huh? And I said, no. We've heard about this place, Africa. It has lots of animals. God, there must be a lot of Sawla there, huh? No, there aren't any. And you have to understand, Laos and Vietnam live next door to Thailand, which is a very now fairly prosperous, well-developed country, and they are sort of... The undercurrent message is Thailand has a lot more than they do, and China has a lot more than they do. So then you say, you know, Thailand doesn't have Sawla. China doesn't have Sawla. Some of the other provinces in Laos, like near the capital city, don't have Sawla. The only place in the world it's found is around your villages. Man, Mary Charlotte, you can just see. They pause. You can see the paradigm shift going in their brain. Probably the first time in their lives, you know, all these, you know, development people coming through, someone is telling them not what they lack, but something that they have that the rest of the world doesn't, that the rest of the world is interested in. That's a very powerful message for them.
One other little thing, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, but with this reward system for the camera trap photographs that might be in the watershed of a given village or whatever, there could also be rewards for photographs of rare muntjac or
sure.
Other creatures.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to focus just on Sawla, but Sawla would be part of it.
I think that'll be the plan. We'll have a whole menu of prices agreed on with the villagers. And again, this is going to be their project. You know, we're just going to go in and offer this to them. But I've known them, these villagers, for a very long time, and I'm quite sure they'll be happy to be part of it. So yeah, maybe... You know, I don't know, maybe $200 for Sawla, $100 for tiger, $50 for clouded leopard, $50 for muntjac.
Based on how common these animals are?
Yeah, and the Annamite Mountains has stuff that's not found anywhere else in the world, these rare deer and rare primates and things. So
this becomes true community-based conservation, where
exactly.
You're recruiting the community to be advocates and agents for the protection of the wildlife, because it's in their benefit to do so.
Well, this is a theme that comes up over and over as we talk about international, or, I mean, that would be true here too, but especially international conservation, the people have to be on board with it. There has to be something in it for them, and if there's an economic benefit for them to do conservation, then is when it starts to work.
Exactly.
We talked the other day on this program about prairie dogs and their keystone species and whatnot, and it's very important to save them, not just because they're cute, which they are, and not just because they're on the brink of extinction, which they are, but also because they do so much for the land. Now, when you talk about Sawla, what is the motivation to save them?
So darn beautiful. I mean, for me, you know, if you go to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, nobody thinks to ask the curators and guards, why are you doing what you do? You know, it's understood. And for me, it's the same kind of thing. There are very good biological and conservation reasons for saving Sawla. I don't know of another animal in the world that shares Saula's combination of three things for people interested in biodiversity conservation. It's biological distinctiveness. It has a lot. I mean, its genetic resources are unique because there's no other species of Saula in the world. So it's biological distinctiveness, number one. Number two, its degree of endangerment. And number three, the paucity of conservation attention to it. So there are, as well there should be, there are millions of dollars and people working full-time to conserve, you know, panda, orangutan, tiger, Asian elephant. None of these are as remotely threatened with extinction as Saula is. But there's almost no attention paid to Saula. It's just this unknown thing. But that isn't what motivates me, and I don't think it motivates most other biologists. We just think this stuff is fascinating and beautiful. And we conservationists, we often get up in front of public fora and in journals, and we make sort of the rare disease cure argument for conservation, that, oh, we should save the Amazon because there might be a cure for cancer there, and we have to save wildlife because this can save ecosystem services. While it's true, that's not why any of us are doing this. I wasn't fascinated by birds. That's what I started out in as a kid, because they might have a cure for cancer. There's actually a danger in making that argument. If you convince Brazil that they need to conserve the Amazon because, you know, there might be a cure for cancer there, if you find a cure for cancer in the lab, they say, well, you told us we had to save it for that, so now let's cut it down. Also, people are only inspired by what inspires you. And that's not really what I don't think inspires most wildlife biologists. So just to only make that utilitarian argument for biodiversity is not really inspiring. And I think we have to have more confidence to just say this is beautiful. The world is going to be impoverished. This is like losing an evolutionary piece of or work of art that's been being painted for 5 million years.
I agree. I think saving the Saula is like saving a species of poetry. We were talking, both of you mentioned the Saula's similarity to the unicorn earlier in its looks, in the horns that it has, in its rarity, in the serenity of its disposition. It's a kind of embodiment of the mystery and elusiveness of nature. And for that reason alone, it's worth making every effort to keep it on the planet.
I've been thinking so much lately about the way that we think about life, and we're very focused on the sanctity of human life, many people of all political stripes, but on all other life, the idea that it is something, I mean, of course, you know, we grow plants and we eat them, we grow animals and we eat them, but that there's something else going on too, which is that these are in themselves sacred beings that have a right to live and run around. Mm-hmm. And yeah, maybe we're part of the food chain and that's all part of the evolutionary process and so on. But even things that are part of the food chain, they still have this place that is not to be desecrated.
Right. And I think you can even make sort of a utilitarian argument for beauty. The biologist E.O. Wilson wrote a fascinating book called Biophilia. And he made an argument that encoded in human genes is an attraction for nature and forest. And he makes a very persuasive argument of why this is the case. And so if nature and forest and greenery is lost, humans are going to be stressed and suffer psychologically, even if they are not even aware of the cause. So you can even make a utilitarian argument for the beauty side of it.
And people talk about nature deficit disorder and whatnot.
Yeah. I just came from a very interesting week in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was invited out by an excellent group called the Wildlife Conservation Network. And I encourage anybody to check these people out on the internet. I'm somewhat new to them, but they're sort of like a matchmaking service between prosperous people in the United States, especially the Western U.S., who want to make a contribution to wildlife conservation. And they match them up with people doing grassroots wildlife conservation at the local level in developing countries, so that these donors can give money directly to grassroots people doing the work on the ground rather than to a big organization. And yeah, these donors, again, they're motivated to support just these animals. You know, they donate money to cheetahs because cheetahs are beautiful. Of course, they are persuaded by the utilitarian argument of keeping the ecosystem in balance with predators and prey. But the bottom line of it, that's more of the intellectual justification. They want to do it because these things are beautiful. So I don't think you always have to make sort of this economic utilitarian argument, even to, you know, non-biologists who are interested in supporting this.
So you went out to the meeting of the Wildlife Conservation Network and you made a presentation about the Sao La.
Right, yeah.
How'd that go?
It was great because, as I said, Sao La is sort of like, you know, as I said, the Cinderella of wildlife conservation. Nobody knows about it.
It's Cinderella before the ball.
Exactly. She hasn't gotten into the carriage. The pumpkin hasn't been turned into the carriage yet. But it's an incredible, compelling story. And I found just once people hear the story, they're inspired by it. So it was very useful to sort of get Sao La on the radar. And this Wildlife Conservation Network, it's a very interesting, powerful concept where it was founded basically by Silicon Valley entrepreneurs in large part. One of them was Akiko Yamazaki, the wife of the Yahoo founder Jerry Yang. And what they bring is these skills and this knowledge of communication, project management, networking, skills that, you know, us biologists out in the boonies often don't have. So they bring these very high-profile management and business skills, marry them with the skills of the biologists in the field, and that's a really powerful synergy. So it's a cool thing that they're doing.
We're talking to Bill Robichaud and Bill Dubuis about the Sao La. Bill Dubuis, you have been observing this and are basically documenting the history of, as it's being made right now, of the effort to save this mammal.
Well, that's right. I was fortunate to have been invited last year in August to go and sit in on a meeting of the Sao La Working Group of the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, in Vientiane in Laos. And that's when I met Bill and a number of other people involved in the effort to conserve and keep Sao La on Earth. And I'm looking forward. I'm expecting sometime early in 2011 to join Bill on a trip into Nakai Nan Tun. And when Bill will be working with village elders and so forth and trying to develop this system he mentioned a little while ago concerning the camera traps and the rewards. And I'll try to document this process and write about it, and actually pull it into a slightly larger context, because the Asian wildlife trade is a terrible having terrible impact on nature today. And we usually think about, when we think about extinction, it's an abstraction. You know, you can't touch it, you can't explore it with your senses. It's an absence, a nothing. And for people really to care about extinction, you have to make it particular. It has to wear a face. And the Sao La can be, in a way, for a lot of people, I think, the face of extinction. And through writing about Sao La, one can write about these larger issues in the Asian wildlife trade.
I heard there was a funny thing that made an impression on me. And whatever somebody's thing is, there was this moment. And for me, somebody had a cell phone ringtone that was the sound of this wonderful songbird that had gone extinct 45 or 50 years ago, and there was a recording of it. And this ringtone was the only remnant of it. And the weirdness and poignancy and sadness of that really hit me.
Yeah, yeah. Fortunately, there won't be a ringtone for Sao La.
No.
Because I heard it make a noise in captivity. It in the 18 days I watched her, she made two vocalizations, but it was just like two little goat bleats. That was it.
Let's go back for a moment to the Wildlife Conservation Network. I love this idea of essentially a matchmaking service for people who want to give money to conservation and grassroots groups who desperately need it. And in that way, you're bypassing, and not that there's anything wrong with a lot of these major groups that do, they're, you know, that have a high profile and so on, they're doing wildlife conservation. But this is basically getting people to give directly to people like you and the Sao La Working Group without any middleman.
Exactly. In fact, the Wildlife Conservation Network, or WCN, 93% of the donations they get go directly to the field projects. They have a staff of, I think, only six, and they rely on this huge army of volunteers. Like, they put on this week-long wildlife expo, which they've been planning for all year. Almost all the staff of it were volunteers. So they're very efficient. And, and they have the donors directly meet the conservationists. In fact, the donors have gone out to visit some of the projects they support in Africa and other places. And it's that part of the model is very interesting, and also giving wildlife biologists because whether you have a project to save a Sao La or cheetahs or develop and sell a new software, the fundamentals are the same. Because wildlife conservation, we think, you probably think wildlife biologists spend most of their time just with wild animals, darting them, putting radio collars on them. But that's not it. Wildlife will do fine on its own. Wildlife conservation is work with people. It's people that are the issue. So you have wildlife conservationists. If you're not working with people, you're probably not really doing wildlife conservation. And so all these skills of working with people and, managing staff and connecting with people that business people have to do very well or they're not going to survive are very important skills for wildlife biologists to have as well.
As we know from the conversations that we have about the drug trade, you can do all the intervention you want. As long as there's still a market for drugs, some way or other, people are going to get them. They're going to get into your country. It seems like there would have to be some real reduction in the demand for that kind of traditional Chinese medicine in order for wildlife of Asia and beyond to not be decimated by this trade.
Exactly. And there are actually some excellent programs going on in China. I think some of them are through WWF. And if there's another organization that's doing that I've forgotten, I apologize. But there's these very excellent ad campaigns just trying to show Chinese the connection between this pill that they're buying in a market and where it's coming from, the living animal that it's coming from. But it takes probably about a generation to change an attitude. And so these grassroots conservation projects also have an essential role to play just to keep these animals from going extinct while these attitudinal changes are made in the countries that buy the stuff. Both are essential, and I agree. If you're just working on one or the other, they're not a solution. They have to be done in parallel. And the Asian medicine trade it's affecting the United States. I mean, there are bears being poached in the national parks in America whose paws are destined for markets in Asia.
Oh, Lord.
And by the same token, if you're in Washington, D.C., there are small markets on New York Avenue where you can buy monkey and
exactly.
Other bushmeats.
And this is something I'd like to just address, Mary Charlotte, is when you work in developing countries, you see reports on biodiversity conservation by, very good, well-intentioned agencies like the United Nations Development Program or some of the big development banks. And there's a very common leitmotif you read in almost all of these reports, and they talk about the causes of biodiversity loss in developing countries like Laos. Poverty. Poverty is one. Nonsense. Well, not quite nonsense. The main drivers of threatened wildlife loss in these countries is not poverty, it's wealth. It's the emerging middle classes, wealthy classes in China, Vietnam, United States is the demand. And I'm tired of the poor being blamed for biodiversity loss. They don't have the voice. And it's not the poor. Markets are not driven by supply, they're driven by demand. If I was a Lao and I saw a turtle worth $8,000, I'd pick it up too. I mean, this guy's got to feed his family and everything else. And this is something that's unfortunate. And the reason it's, number one, it's not fair. Number two, it directs you to inappropriate solutions. So you think, we just solve the issue of poverty in Laos and everything will be fine with biodiversity. That's not the case. In fact, there was a, and this is not, a, I mean, obviously poverty alleviation has to be done, but don't expect it to conserve biodiversity, at least not in the short term. There was a very interesting study done in villages in northern Laos. It was a socioeconomic study, because the perception is, oh, these are poor people and they're out shooting wildlife because they need to eat and support their families. Well, it's a nice idea, but it's actually not a reflection of reality quite often. In the study in northern Laos, the villagers, the residents, were grouped into three economic categories in the village, basically kind of poor, middle income, and wealthy. The wealthiest families ate the most wildlife, and the poor families the least. The poor don't have time. They're too busy finding their main source of food, which is like fish in the rivers or growing their food or growing the rice. They can't afford the guns and the bullets and the free time to set the snares. So the answer is, if you alleviate the poverty and get everybody wealthy in this village, is that going to solve the biodiversity crisis? No, it's not going to do it.
Well, and as we've seen, I mean, with so many people on the planet, when people achieve a middle-class lifestyle, they get a car, they get a single-family house of some kind, yeah, they take up more room, they use more resources.
Sure. Absolutely. It was
I should say we.
At the Wildlife Conservation Network, one of the biologists from Africa, it was very interesting, it's a different perspective in Africa possibly, they said one of their goals is they're trying to make bushmeat, you know, wild meat that's sown in market, more expensive, so it's harder for people to buy it. In Asia, it's the exact opposite problem. The reason it's a problem is bushmeat is expensive. It's a luxury good, so villagers go out to shoot it to sell it to the markets to get income. In most of Southeast Asia, wild meat is a luxury. It's always more expensive than domestic meat, so only the wealthy have access to it, you know, to buy it.
We're talking to Bill Robichaud and Bill Dubuis about the mammal, the sow la. So what is, I mean, after all this kind of conversation that we're having, and you've been there for many years, Bill Robichaud, doing this, and Bill Dubuis documenting all of this, what's the prognosis? What's the plan?
Can I back up and mention one more beautiful thing about the sow la first?
Yes.
Is its name. It's a Lao term that means spinning wheel arms or spinning wheel posts. A la is the name for a little local spinning wheel that the villagers use to spin cotton and silk thread. And the drum is held up by two arms, and those are the sow. It means post or arms in the Lao language. So the villagers call it that because of the sow la's long tapering horns are about the same size and shape as these arms. So the name literally means spinning wheel arms.
Nice.
That's what they call it. So the prognosis, is this a winnable effort to save sow la from extinction? Absolutely. And one of the main opportunities is no price on its head. It's things for rhinos and elephants, for example, and tigers are tough because you've got poachers racing the conservationists to the last, you know, rhinos for the rhino horn and the tiger for the tiger bone, or tiger bone. Nobody's out trying to kill sow la, and that's a great opportunity for its conservation. What we're doing now, I'm in the midst of spending about 3 months fairly intensively working with partners in Laos and Vietnam and our sow la working group to design a comprehensive strategy or project to save sow la from extinction. And it's going to be two country. It's going to be collaborative across Laos and Vietnam and involve conservation NGOs, industry, and the Lao government. And once that's done, we're going to have another meeting of the sow la working group to discuss the plan and assign responsibilities. All right, who's going to be doing which part of this at 9 o'clock on Monday morning?
Is there any sense that people have, like, oh, who are these Americans coming in telling us what to do?
No, I don't think, because the sow la working group has Lao and Vietnamese members on it, from both government and from NGOs. So no, it's very much a shared collaborative effort. And if the general public wants to get involved, or any of your readers, they can go to...
And listeners.
And listeners. I'm sure all your listeners can read as well. We have a website, SaveTheSaola.org, all small case, one word, and Saola is spelled S-A-O-L-A. They can also search the, just Google the IUCN Asian Wild Cattle Specialist Group, and they'll find a link to Saola there. But SaveTheSaola.org is where they could go. They can also, they can email me at the Saola Working Group, which is saolawg@gmail.com.
WG for Working Group.
Yeah, or they can email me at williamrobichaud@yahoo.com. Just William Robichaud, one word.
I'll try to put all this stuff on SantaFeRadioCafe.org as well. And also for the Wildlife Conservation Network, they're on the web at wildnet.org if people want to look that stuff up.
Yeah, yeah, I recommend it. And Mary Charlotte, I think the Saola story, it's compelling in itself, but I think it's can be particularly compelling for American audiences because, you know, we may have had good intentions, but we did a lot of damage in that part of the world. As I said, Laos is the most bombed country per capita in the history of conflict. And this, the Ho Chi Minh Trail area, which was one of the principal targets of the bombing in Laos and Vietnam, is where the Annamite Mountains are and where Saola occurs. So maybe as Americans, we can get involved in where we once destroyed, now help to restore this area by conserving this thing of incredible beauty, the Saola and the Annamite Mountains. And so I think it's actually quite a compelling thing for American listeners to be involved in.
Do you have any Vietnam veterans, for example, who are involved in this?
No, not yet, not that I know of. And this is, if you want to get involved in like incremental wildlife conservation, this has all sort of just been taking off in the last year, this really focused effort to conserve Saola. So we're really at sort of the startup grassroots level. And so it's a great, you know, I encourage people to get involved in elephant conservation and tiger conservation. But that's been going on for a long time with a lot of people involved and a lot of money doing great things. Saola is just, like, Saola conservation is just getting birthed in the last year.
Well, I think, didn't you say when you were here last November that this was the first radio broadcast ever on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe on this subject?
Yes, and this is now the second, I believe.
I hope not. I hope you've had lots of, or that you will soon have lots of publicity about this.
Yeah.
It began here. Let everyone know this is where it began.
And part of the concern, I mean, I've been working on Saola for a dozen years, but sort of through the back door, through other projects and conservation projects in Laos, in part because it's been very hard to raise money for Saola because no one's ever heard of it. People, you know, it's easy to raise money for things people have heard of and already know the story of, like elephants and tigers and jaguars and things. Saola's been much, people don't even know if it's vegetable, animal, or mineral.
Right.
So that's the first thing we have to do is get the word out on this animal before it's too late.
Bill Robichaud is a wildlife biologist. He's the coordinator of the Saola Working Group. You can go to SaveTheSaola.org, S-A-O-L-A is how you spell this animal. Bill DuBois is a writer and conservationist, longtime friend of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. It's just great to see you both again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest. This is a great gift to us and to Saola.
Thank you.